and welcome to the Eastern Front. My name is Giselle Donnelly, and I'm a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. I am joined today by my colleague,
Yulia Zsozsa, with the Middle East Institute, Georgetown, and George Washington Universities.
And the third stooge, Dalibor, is off running a marathon or something like that. But we are extremely lucky to be joined by George Barros, who's an analyst with the Institute for the Study of War. We rely on ISW quite a bit because they have the most authoritative tracking of developments on the Ukraine battlefield. And that's where we're going to start today. On our podcast, we do talk about the many challenges to European peace that have arisen along a line that runs from the Baltic Sea to the Black Sea, what we call the Eastern Front, and about why those are important to the United States. Remember, if you enjoy this episode, please subscribe, rate, and review us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. George, welcome to our Modest Artisanal podcast. You're a first-time offender, so you'll be released on your own cognizance when the show is over, but we're both very pleased to have you join us at last. And I think we should just jump in and listen to you for a bit and listen to your summation of where things stand in Ukraine these days.
Thank you so much for having me, Giselle and Yulia. It's a real pleasure, hopefully the first of many. Absolutely. Let's jump into it with the current status on the front lines. So the Ukrainian forces right now, they're in a very difficult place. But I'm actually not as pessimistic as a lot of other observers, I think, have been characterizing the situation. But let's not sugarcoat it. The Russian forces, they have the initiative across the theater. They've had it since about October 2023, and that's a very important factor. A lot of people talk about who's winning, who's losing, but I like to talk in terms of the initiative. And that means the Russians, of course, they're able to conduct offensives at their time, place, and choosing level of intensity. And the Russians, in our assessment, they have this specific campaign design that's designed to stretch the Ukrainians across this 600-mile-long theater front line, pin them down in order to try to facilitate some tactical and operational breakthroughs. Over the last month, Russian forces have continued to make these small tactical gains. In our assessment, they're not threatening to create any operational gains or any significant breakthrough that they're going to be able to exploit. What we've seen is the Russians actually accelerate the rate of their offensives in order to capitalize on this increasingly shrinking window before the American security system connected to the now passed supplemental can actually make its way to the theater and to the front lines, which will take some weeks. Just to put into hard concrete numbers, in the last month between April 1st and May 1st, 2024, Russian forces seized about 75 square kilometers in eastern Ukraine. That's a very, very modest number, roughly about the size of Manhattan. So it's not a whole lot of territory, but nonetheless, there's all this big doom and gloom, I think, that's overshadowing this. And I expect that as American aid starts to actually trickle to the front lines, the situation will stabilize and the Ukrainians should be able to blunt this Russian offensive. Looking into the closer future, I expect that if the Ukrainians get the aid in an expeditious way, they might be able to conduct some limited counteroffensive operations as early as late 2024 or early 2025 and try to contest that initiative. I'm not talking about a major offensive operation like how the Ukrainians attempted last summer, but a smaller scoped operation or series of operations to try to wrestle away that initiative, to make it so that the Ukrainians actually impose some dilemmas on the Russian command, force the Russians to make some prioritization decisions and throw them off kilter, as opposed to the current situation, which is the Russians choosing when and where to create dilemmas for the Ukrainians. More immediately, we're forecasting a threat for a new major Russian offensive effort in the northeast. We've seen some indication of the Russians redeploying forces from the theater towards Belgorod and Kursk, and this could potentially set conditions for a new offensive against the major Ukrainian city of Kharkiv or potentially Sumy. Rest assured, we're not concerned about the Russian forces' ability to seize the city. In our assessment, they might try and they will likely fail if they do. They're not going to seize Kharkiv city. They tried at a much higher strength level back in 2022 and failed, and they're in a worse place now to do that now than before. But in terms of battlefield geography, we're very concerned what kind of pressures an offensive on Kharkiv might make across this larger front line. Because if the Ukrainians make a decision to prioritize defending Kharkiv, it might stretch the Ukrainians thin in Donetsk, you know, stretching the Ukrainians and enabling or increasing the chances of a Russian breakthrough. And I think the Russian command understands this. And so the Russian command, with their intent for any future operation in the northeast, is not to decisively seize a major strategic city in the northeast, but to strategically thin out the Ukrainian defense to facilitate the campaign in the east. I think for the rest of the year, 2024, Donetsk Oblast is going to be the main Russian effort. And if you're interested, we can zoom in and talk about some of the specific battles we've seen over the recent weeks. But this is sort of the high level situation that we're tracking.
Yeah, I'd love to go into that. And I think then maybe we can talk a little bit also about the weapons on both sides and how that can likely impact the situation on the battlefield. But you seem to be describing sort of two possible efforts along this very long battle line in the north on the one end and in the south on the other end. And I want to build, as we're making you make predictions into the near future, the summer and early fall, I would like to try to connect that to what has happened at the beginning of this year, specifically the loss of Avdiivka. And I've seen and heard analysts, military analysts over the past few months after the fact, sort of worrying about what is happening in the south based on that, that Avdiivka is connected strategically and in the strategic aims of the Russians, or could be connected to the wider effort to make significant progress in the south and not just limiting themselves in the coming months to Donetsk, that we know they want to take entirely as according to the laws of occupation and annexation, but also that they're eyeing specifically Odessa. And if Odessa falls, then they can go further south into Moldova, etc. So would you help us make sense of what you've seen happening in the south in the past few months and how you're connecting this to what we might be looking at in terms of Russian attempts or efforts in the coming months?
Yeah, absolutely. On the south, it seems right now that the Russians are actually deprioritizing the southern axis in order to double down and send more resources to the east to focus on the campaign for Donetsk Oblast. There's not been a whole lot of changes in the south over the last 6 to 9 months. The biggest tactical changes that we observe are that there's a village in the Zaporizhia pocket that the Ukrainians carved out as part of their 2023 counteroffensive. It's called Robotyne. And Ukrainians seized it. It was supposed to be an easy tactical objective for the Ukrainians. The Ukrainians spent a long time fighting very hard for that village, and their offensive didn't go much further beyond it. The Russians have made some tactical gains in recent weeks there. There was a video that went around that was geolocated that showed a Russian soldier hoisting the Russian flag in the center of the village. Even to this very day, the Russians say, okay, we've made some progress into this tiny village, but it's still contested. The eastern part's contested. The northern part's contested. So, frankly, it's not that interesting. But what is interesting is, you know, there are two major Russian formations that actually deployed to the south in the heat of the battle in summer 2023 in order to blunt that Ukrainian offensive. And those were two elite airborne divisions, the 7th Division and the 76th Airborne Division. Those were pulled from other parts of the theater. The 76th came from the east in Luhansk, and then the 7th came from Kherson. And they converged in Zaporizhia, and they played a pivotal role in reinforcing the Russian defense to prevent the exploitation of a Ukrainian breakthrough. What's very, very interesting, and is honestly a really big tell, is as of 2 days ago, ISW collect indicators suggesting that these two formations might be redeploying from the Zaporizhia part of the theater to the east. We had some reports from a Russian airborne source that talked about how there was a senior level Russian military decision to redeploy them to an unspecified area in the theater, that they're leaving the area of operations that they were previously in. And then a very well-respected Ukrainian military journalist reported that the 76 was going to redeploy and go specifically towards Ukraine. I want to be clear, we've not seen any confirmed data that shows demonstrably that these units are redeploying. We're very close eye on it, but it would be a very big deal if these divisions do redeploy. We assess they're in pretty good standing. They've had a lot of time to reconstitute. They've not been involved in super intense combat operations for the last 3 or 4 months. That's been a relatively lower tempo in the south. And if they do indeed redeploy to the east, especially in a quick time window, that would suggest really the Russians are trying to augment their offensive capabilities in the east to try to exploit the tactical gains they've made around Avdiivka and reinforce that effort, reinforce the successes before the U.S. aid comes. At the same time, I think it also indicates a deprioritization of the south, because if they were going to try to make more presses, like you said, across the Dnieper River to get towards Mykolaiv, head in the direction of Odessa, we'd be looking at a Russian buildup in that part of the sector, but we're actually seeing indications of redeployment. I just want to put into scale the rate of Russian advance there. The tactical advances have not been particularly alarming for us. We've seen sort of this Russian protrusion out there. They've made this little salient that they've carved out over the last 2-3 weeks. But in the grand scheme of things, Since the Russians seized Avdiivka back in February, as of today, the Russians have only expanded the farthest tippy-most point of their protrusion to be about, I'm looking at my map now, it's like about a little over 10 kilometers. So it's a relatively small amount of gain at great cost. They now have to move some division-level assets to the east, presumably to support these offensive sort of efforts. U.S. aid is coming, so the window of opportunity for the Russians to break through here is closing. And the Russians are tired. Let us not forget that the offensive campaign for Avdiivka started in October. So they've been at this for well over 6 months at this point, and they're going to need to rest. And they've actually not taken very many operational pauses on this offensive effort. It's been very aggressive for a sustained period. So I suspect that the Russians will make a couple more tactical gains in Avdiivka. We've used satellite imaging to find where the main Ukrainian defensive line in the area is, and it's actually a little bit slightly further to the west of there. So there is a little bit of depth that the Ukrainians can play with before they get to the operation of significant territory. And I expect that the tempo will slow down in the coming.
Let's sort of zoom out, you know, or step back one terrain feature or something like that. And let me just float a couple of thoughts / hypotheses. I have to say, I'm still a little bit skeptical of the idea that the Russians could mount simultaneous or near simultaneous major campaigns. And if there were to be a thrust toward Kharkiv, I mean, that would take a long time to set up. It'd be a huge signature associated with preparing for that, et cetera, et cetera. So first of all, George, if you give us kind of your thoughts about how many major efforts the Russians are capable of undertaking. And secondly, how big the window of opportunity really is for two reasons. First of all, American weapons are now coming, presumably also, although God knows how many and what version of things like ATACMS and longer range strike systems. And secondly, the Ukrainians have worked very hard to develop their own longer range strike options. So again, these are all very fluid elements, but for the Russians to achieve a major success, when you sort of stack all these things up or add them all up, strike me as, you know, maybe within the realm of possibility, but not at all probable. And if they were to, you know, they have to reckon that the casualty rate is likely to climb back up too, because their rear areas will be less secure. I mean, we could be seeing something that sort of reverts to the first year of the war, where the Ukrainians were pretty successful at striking arms caches and depots and logistics hubs. I doubt that the Russian army has gotten any better at long-range, large-scale logistics. You know, it's still a railroad-based army in many ways. So I know that was a long statement in the form of a question or a question in the form of a statement, but I'd be interested in your thoughts about that next of stuff.
It's a great question, Giselle, and thanks for posing it. I have three sort of bulleted thoughts and reactions that I'll share with that. I 100% agree with you. I share your skepticism about the Russian military's ability to conduct consecutive or even simultaneous major offensive efforts. And that's part of the reason why we assess that the Kharkiv effort, if they decide to commence with it, will fail. We think that the Russians understand that, and that's not the point. It's just to try to squeeze a couple Ukrainian brigades away from the east and send them to the north in order to facilitate major in the east. Therefore, the effort in the north not necessarily be the cleanest, most successful, most well-prepared, most effectively and skillfully executed operation if it's really just like a big fixing operation, if that makes sense, and it would be a supporting effort. That's how we're inclined to see that major effort. So seize direct power, but just fix a lot of combat power. Agree with all your points on logistics. We've not observed a Russian capability to increase what they previously demonstrated, and if they do pull this off and they have suddenly become much more sophisticated and capable, that would be a major inflection, and it would surprise us, and we'd have to go back to our drawing boards and reassess, okay, what changed in the course of the last 9 or so months where all of a sudden the Russian capability for sustaining and waging such offensives have significantly increased. I suspect they have, but there are some important operational level innovations that the Russians have actually demonstrated that are granting novel capability, and in particular the development of the Russian glide bombs. The glide bombs are not a silver bullet, but they played a pivotal role in the seizure of Avdiivka. And it's the first time that we've seen the Russians be able to use their air force to directly support the ground forces in a combined fashion. They started mass producing, you know, the glide bomb kits that convert the massive amounts of these dummy Soviet-era 500-kilogram bombs into something approximating the JDAM. And even though they're not that accurate, the destructive power is tremendous, and they just hit it with volume, and there is no countermeasure. So that's like thought one and two. I agree with you in the logistics. However, the integration of the glide bombs in a combined fashion is actually a new combined arms tactic that is effective and for which the Ukrainians don't have a countermeasure. And part three of that is very, very concerned about the ability of the Russians to actually leverage their Federation as a sanctuary, safe space, in order to support offensive operations. As you know, the Biden administration, they've by diktat said that the Ukrainians are not allowed to use American-provided systems against military targets in Russian airspace or on Russian ground. And that's unfortunate because just by the curse of geography, Kharkiv City is located 40 kilometers from the international border with Russia. The glide bomb range varies how what is reported, but it's about 40 to 60 kilometers. And that means that Russian fixed-wing aircraft can conduct an infinite number of glide bomb attacks without ever being risked of being interdicted by Patriot systems. The Ukrainians can have an infinite number of Patriot systems, and they can be close to Kharkiv City, but if we grant Russian airspace as a sanctuary, then there's no way to actually defeat the glide bomb threat against Kharkiv City. And they can use those glide bombs en masse to obliterate the targets. So I think it's very important that the administration and the White House and the security apparatus in general, we reevaluate our decision to give Russia this sanctuary. With regards to logistics too, the sanctuary protects the logistics. If you're going to send all of your rear area support, your fuel, your ammunition, your vehicle reconstitution zones, even the forward assembly areas before you cross the line, if you can't use your most effective rocket artillery, HIMARS systems, and ATACMS against stuff that's in Belgorod Oblast, just a little bit over the border, then that's free range for the Russians to be able to project that force into Ukraine. I've done a little bit of studying to try to quantify exactly how big this sanctuary is, and I crunched some numbers, and this is before the Ukrainians reportedly received the 300-kilometer munition subvariant for the ATACMS. But if you assume that the Ukrainians can strike stuff with the 170-kilometer range ATACMS from the front line of Ukrainian forces, then there is a area within the Russian Federation that is about 145 square kilometers. I mean, it's a territory larger than Greece, in which there's over 200 square kilometers of known military land use. You know, like five major bases, the headquarters for many regiments and brigades, the headquarters for a variety of other units, you know, motor pools, all kinds of stuff. And these are things that the Ukrainians look at. They could hit with their little rinky-dink cheap drones, but really don't have the payloads necessary to damage those larger infrastructure. And unfortunately, those are systems that the American weapons can't hit. I think we can really increase the efficacy of American aid and, you know, make those dollars that we've just appropriated go a lot further by allowing the Ukrainians to strike things destined to end up in Ukraine while they're still in Russia before they get into Ukraine.
We've heard you loud and clear on something that we've talked about also many times before on the podcast, so we won't be doing a rant now one more time about why this is absolutely untenable and makes no sense whatsoever, and that we shouldn't be guided by fears, but rather by strategy. So we'll leave it aside, but we've heard it loud and clear. I also want to ask you for a bit of an overview from your perspective on how much, you sort of alluded to it, how much Ukraine can hope to attain in terms of both offense and defense in the coming month with this aid package. I know you guys are looking at Russia primarily and not at Ukraine, but you've had the experience of seeing what the package has brought last year, the 2023 package. And in my understanding, the numbers are somewhat comparable and the quality of weapons is somewhat comparable. And you've added the long range ATACMS part just now. And so looking ahead with the roughly one third of the package that is dedicated to weapons for Ukraine, as opposed to replenishing our stocks here and economic and financial aid for Ukraine, what kind of weapons, essentially, what kind of equipment, what kind of capabilities will the Ukrainians, in your understanding, have to rely on from what they're getting from the United States? Is it still heavily, as it was last year, an artillery war? And are we looking at primarily the issue of ammunition. Will the ATACMS for the long-range weapons, will they make a big difference? What do you see the Ukrainians getting out of the package that we are about to send them, of course, in the coming days and weeks, but going into the rest of the year? What are the highlights?
Yeah, that's a great question. Just I'm not a logistician, I'm not a policy planner, so take what I have to say with a grain of salt. But for what it's worth, I completely agree that this is still an artillery-dominated war. High volume of artillery fires is 155, main field gun rounds. That is absolutely critical for maintaining defense, and it's a key enabler for offense. So volume, production capacity for that is going to still be key for offense, for defense, for everything. So I expect that we'll see a whole lot of surging on that, and the Europeans are also, separate of what we've done with our appropriations, the Europeans are doing a great job with working on capacity building in Europe as well. In terms of what the Ukrainians will need and rely on for the future, 100%, they're going to need the long-range strike that ATACMS have. Even if we discount the sanctuary within Russia, there's a huge territory inside of Ukraine and Luhansk and Donetsk that the Ukrainians aren't able to effectively strike because of the limitations for their aid and what they've actually had with the volume of ATACMS. So I welcome the decision to send a higher volume of those to actually generate some of those larger effects. And the other systems that the Ukrainians are going to rely on are, I think, vehicles and breaching equipment. The Ukrainians are currently in the process of forming 10 new brigades, and they also need to restore the existing brigades that are degraded from the previous counteroffensive in 23 and the last 9+ months of defensive operations. And for that, they're going to need more Bradleys, more M113s, especially for casualty evacuation. They're going to need more main battle tanks. There's a question as to should those be Abrams versus Leopards and bring those from the Europeans. But the Bradleys seem to be really well suited and performing quite well in Ukraine. And they're going to need a whole lot of those. I think the Ukrainians currently, I suspect they're not going to have enough armored capability to be able to properly equip 10 new brigades and all the battalions. And so that, armor and breaching equipment in particular is going to be a really big challenge. In terms of thinking about the Ukrainian requirements, I like to think less in terms of systems, but more in terms of capabilities and how we can achieve certain kinds of effects in perhaps unorthodox sort of ways. We're thinking a lot about what does it take to actually conduct an armored mechanized penetration into a fortified zone. The Russians have created these elaborate field fortifications, 3 lines thick, 4 lines thick, with dragon's teeth, the trenches, the landmines, razor wire, all that stuff. And the breacher requirements are high. But problem is that the existing US and NATO doctrine on how to do breaching is entirely out of date and become irrelevant because of the new technological capabilities that the Russians have had developed with the proliferation of the drones. Constant surveillance of the battlefield, there's no more tactical surprise, you can be interdicted by the drones themselves, they're integrated into the reconnaissance strike system and complex where you can call in direct fire and indirect fire as you approach the breaching area. So we actually have to rethink about how do we achieve the necessary effects necessary for conducting a breach with the systems we have. One thing that we've been thinking about a lot is how can the Ukrainians use precision rocket artillery, and how can they use drones in order to achieve the effects of battlefield air interdiction? That is, disrupting in depth the ability of a force to be able to move at the operational level, resources, logistics, and support in rear, and sort of geographically isolate the sector of the front where you're trying to conduct your breakthrough. Now, according to all the doctrinal textbooks, you conduct and achieve the effects of battlefield air interdiction with fixed-wing aircraft. You bomb bridges, you deny highways, you disrupt things to prevent material from getting in and out of a given sector, but the Ukrainians will be able to do that with fixed-wing aircraft. But maybe if you had a high volume of ATACMS or HIMARS with a sufficient ability to keep putting fires on a bridge or a highway or something, maybe you could generate the same prerequisite requirements and effects of battlefield air interdiction, but without fixed-wing aircraft. And maybe the solution for how to be able to breach a highly fortified, prepared area is, without fixed-wing aircraft, is you use all these rockets, use all these missiles, use them in a different way from which they're doctrinally envisioned of being used, but to achieve a commensurate effect. And then, of course, you need more breaching equipment, you'll need to think about how to survive and bring the forces into there, how to overcome electronic warfare. So there's a whole lot of systems and there's a lot of Western arsenal of what we could give them, but the arsenal is insufficient. We actually have to get very creative about how we think about generating the effects that we need to generate with the tools that we have, how to overcome these technical adaptations. So we're thinking hard about these sort of things, and it's larger than just the systems.
George, you made a passing reference now to something that I wanted to draw you out on that I think would be quite useful if we could explain to our listeners in as plain English as possible. And that is is the electronic warfare contest, if you will. Of course, the Russians have long concentrated on EW and have done a pretty effective job of jamming GPS-guided weaponry and things like that. And I'm sure there's a sort of back and forth cat and mouse game that's going on. I have to say the one thing that is a little perplexing to me, I mean, I understand the Russians have sort of distributed, but there still has to be an emitter that does the jamming, and emitters don't necessarily last very long on the battlefield. So I'd be interested in your take on how the EW balance stands at the moment, and whether, I'm sure the Ukrainians are devoting a heck of a lot of thought and energy to trying to solve this problem, but whether this has penetrated into, you know, Western military thought is uncertain to me.
Sure. Well, given my interactions with U.S. service members and officers and the guys and gals in uniform doing this sort of thinking, we're heading in the right direction of thinking about the modern battlefield and the requirements there and the threat from EW, but we're actually trailing quite behind Ukrainians and the Russians in terms of the realities of what the requirements are. I'll also say that what was true a month ago on the battlefield is no longer true today, because there is a blisteringly fast offense-defense war when it comes to the use of electronic warfare and drones, and the solutions and the test cycles and the R&D for all these systems. I mean, they get fielded, they get so many test cycles, like, you know, years worth of test cycles, which you'd get normally in the civilian world in peacetime conditions, that the solutions that worked, you know, 8 weeks ago are obsolete now. And so there's just a tremendous amount of innovation occurring. With regards to the Russians and how they're doing, I think right now the Russians, they have a qualitative edge in electronic warfare. It's something they've been investing in a long time to strike at the Western, the American Achilles heel, which is GPS-guided and enabled systems. I'm sure you've all seen the report from the gentleman at the Hudson Institute that talked about, you know, the decreased effectiveness of the different American provided, I think it was the Excalibur rounds, decreasing drastically over the course of 6 months due to that jamming, and then also the decreased effectiveness of Gimler's rounds and that sort of thing. That's quite concerning, because frankly, you know, the Americans, in our theory, is when we go to war, we're going to rely on these systems to work, and it seems that they're not working. You know, to change the geographic scope a little bit, there's been a lot of interesting research done about the GPS jamming affecting the Baltic states in general from this emitter that's located apparently now near St. Petersburg, and it supposedly affects a GPS, the American system, but it does not affect GLONASS, which is the Russian GPS system, which doesn't surprise me. They operate on different frequencies, but the Russians are clearly thinking about these ways to create these asymmetric benefits in a conventional large war. I think the Russians, they have the technological superiority, but the thing is quality and also the quantity that they can field. There's a variety of different systems. There's some large systems that create large signatures that can be targeted, and they only exist in certain areas of the theater or the sector. They have to make prioritization decisions on where to put these things. And so by opening up, you know, if the Ukrainians can conduct an offensive operation in the future, they can impose some hard decisions on the Russians. Where do they decide to put their best stuff? That can be helpful for the Ukrainians. The other issue is smaller scale tactical systems that are of high quality that they can actually put on different vehicles. Those are quite limited in number. We've seen this tactic recently where the Russians will create these so-called turtle tanks, where they put a high value electronic warfare denial system on like a lead tank in a group, and then like a small tactical, you know, unit like a platoon or something, and then they'll weld on this big huge amount of, you know, like steel metal plating around it on the top of it, reducing the mobility of the said tank, but it's the lead tank and it's got an EW system on it, and supposedly, you know, it protects the tank and the rest of its accompanying tank units with it as they go into offensive operations. And it seems to be more or less effective, which is, you know, people knock the turtle tanks because they look kind of ridiculous, but when they implement it and it's effective, then it's effective. We're not thinking hard enough about, you know, what the requirements are for fielding EW and making it work. Part of the problem, I think, also is electronic warfare fratricide. There's a ton of electronic warfare fratricide on both the behalf of the Ukrainians and of the Russians. You know, when both sides are flying their own drones, both sides are shooting their own EW interference, they have to deconflict on which radio waves, on how are we going to do the signal hopping for our drones, how are we going to ensure that our assets don't, you know, hit our own drones, that sort of thing. And those are big, complex, you know, technical problems that the both sides are wrestling with right now. And meanwhile, the U.S. Army is thinking about, you know, pushing down more of these drones to like the brigade level, or maybe the battalion level, let alone down to the company and platoon and squad level, like how the Russians and Ukrainians really have gotten very aggressive about it. So watching the innovation that we have going on in Ukraine, it makes me very concerned about the United States, frankly, from adaptations and doctrine perspective, because I think, frankly, the Ukrainians have more to teach us in this domain than we do to them.
So adding maybe to your concerns, my last question here is about Russia and China. We've seen a lot of speculations, a lot of statements, political, including from Secretary of State Blinken, including from head of the CIA Burns and others about the strategic dimensions of Russia China cooperation. There's a lot of speculation among experts who has the upper hand now in terms of technology, who is helping whom. But we also know that specifically on the battlefield, China could have the means to be helping Russia substantially, including with satellite navigation cooperation that the two have formally, I think now for a decade, 2014. And so how worried are you about the extent to which we have proof or we have suggestions that China is helping Russia and is making a difference in terms of Russian warfare on the battlefield in Ukraine?
Yeah, it's extremely worrying. I'm really concerned about how the Chinese are helping the Russians evade sanctions and procure really important niche items that are critical for Russian defense manufacturing. One of the Achilles heels of Russian defense manufacturing are precision machine tools. And actually, the individual tools that plug into precision machine tools like CNCs and electronic lathes and that sort of thing for carving metal and metalworking and that sort of thing. The Chinese have been helping the Russians source a lot of these CNC machines, because when you look at CNC world, really who owns the space? It's like the Germans, the Taiwanese, the Americans to a lesser extent, and then China has been an emerging power in that world as well. There's also some in East Asia and Korea and Japan. But the Chinese are helping the Russians with CNC and lathes, and that's very, very important for Russian defense manufacturing. So the Russians can actually receive a whole lot of wind in their sails from the, and I think, in fact, are receiving wind in their sails from the Chinese, even though the Chinese, as far as we can tell, have not been confirmed to send weapons in large quantities. And I think the Chinese are very unlikely to commit their own forces to fight in Russia's war in Ukraine. But this cooperation is very alarming. But it goes in the other direction as well. The Russians are collecting a tremendous amount of technical knowledge and data about how to fight against American and Western equipment in Ukraine. They're going to be collecting technical information on F-16s. They're collecting technical information about how, you know, Patriots and other and NASAMs and other systems work. They're collecting information about how to defeat those systems by using unique strike packages that include things like hypersonic missiles, ballistic missiles, Iranian-provided drones, and various other munitions that they include in these strike packages. They're learning all kinds of stuff about how Bradleys and different tanks work and different APCs and vehicles work. And they're going to share all that information with the Chinese. And again, the Russians and the Ukrainians, they are the world's preeminent, most experienced fighting forces on what it looks like to conduct conventional major maneuver warfare and positional warfare with all the drone technology and with very aggressive electronic warfare environments. And I'm sure that the Russians are going to share this information with the Chinese. And it's going to be very important because of the way that the Chinese envision the system-centric warfare that they're going to conduct for, you know, their planned operation for Taiwan, if they ever decide to do that. I think the cooperation also highlights a really key grand strategic weakness and vulnerability in Washington's, in the way that we look at the world, in that, you know, we love our COCOMs, and there's always been the strategic debate about, oh, like, yes, what Russia is doing in Ukraine is terrible, but China is a strategic priority, and we need to pivot to China, and basically we have to invest in the Indo-PACOM, you know, area of responsibility, and to which I vehemently disagree. We don't live in an either-or world. We live in a both-and world. Both of these malign actors are working together to support a combined objective of dethroning the United States and our network of democratic liberal allies. And the Iranians are involved, so you have to get, you know, CENTCOM involved, and the North Koreans are also involved in this as well, and have provided a tremendous amount of material. So what we see are the seams of these different ways that we like to partition the world actually colliding, and the approach that states we have to focus on China in order to win in the world is actually incorrect, because we see this crystallizing network of these different actors coming together, and we have to not sacrifice one theater at the expense of the other, because we live in a global interconnected world and the theaters are merging.
Well, that seems like a sufficiently bleak note to conclude the Eastern Front on. We're always looking for the dark cloud without a silver lining. But George, this has been a fabulous deep dive into the current situation, and you've raised a whole number of longer term, larger scale issues. So your punishment will be to come back on the show regularly and geek out with us again. Thank you so much for joining us. It's been a real pleasure. So thank you to George, and from me, Giselle Donnelly, thank you to our listeners for tuning in to the Eastern Front. Our podcast is dedicated to the security challenges that have arisen along the line from the Baltic to the Black Sea, and as George said, also to the Western Pacific. You can find more episodes and additional content on our website, AEI.org, on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcast. I'd also like to say thank you on behalf of my colleague, Yulia Zhoja, and our missing friend, Dalibor Rohat. He'll be back with us next time. Do please get in touch with us on Twitter using the hashtag EasternFrontPod, written as one word. If you enjoyed this episode, please consider subscribing, rating, and reviewing us. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next time.